Let's now take a deeper dive into the issues surrounding inequities in this pandemic. You've probably heard it said that the coronavirus does not discriminate. Anyone can get it, Prince Charles and Tom Hanks too. But this pandemic is highlighting those inequities that already existed for marginalized and underserved communities. In many communities where data is available, we are seeing higher rates of infections and deaths among Black, Latinx, and Indigenous peoples. So what's behind the disturbing trend and what's being done to address it? For more on that, let's turn to our next Points of View roundtable conversation. I sat down virtually with ASU's Mako Fitz Ward, clinical assistant professor and faculty lead of African and African American Studies, and Jessica Solium, assistant research professor and associate director of the Center for Gender Equity in Science and Technology. You'll hear Ward first.
Certain states have been sort of at the forefront of reporting demographic data by race in terms of the infection rates, the death rates, states like Louisiana, Michigan, North Carolina, Illinois. And so for those of us that do research on these populations, this is no surprise at all.
You know, for me, it's not a surprise. We know that one of the concerns, the rising concerns now, is really thinking about some of the conditions that could exacerbate the virus for particular communities. And I work primarily with American Indian communities. And what we know about American Indians is that they suffer disproportionately from hypertension, asthma, cancer, heart and cardiovascular disease. These are factors that could put them at higher risk of fatal complications from the coronavirus. And, you know, there's more and more reporting now on some of these concerns. The chief executive of the National Congress of American Indians was recently interviewed and talked about how when you look at the health disparities in Indian country, these high rates of diabetes, cancer, heart disease, asthma, and then you combine that with overcrowded housing situations where there may be a lot of people in homes with an elder population who may be exposed to carriers. This could really wreak quite a bit of destruction for Indigenous communities, especially those who are concerned about protecting their native or heritage language speakers who tend to be older. And for some communities, there's just a handful of language speakers who are still alive. And so there's growing concern about making sure that people are taking precaution to protect the elders from the virus.
Yeah. I want to talk about what's behind that, because you talk about pre-existing conditions in minority communities, you know, high levels of diabetes or kidney disease or whatever it may be. There's a lot of history and inequity behind that as well. This goes back and back and back.
Absolutely. I think that there are many factors that contribute to the higher death rates that we're seeing in communities of color, specifically African-American, Latinx, and Indigenous communities. And some of these include access to healthcare facilities, higher concentrations of folks living in medically underserved areas, historical mistrust of the healthcare system, you know, what many have referred to in the African-American community as the Tuskegee effect, for example. I think when we think about undocumented immigrants, the fear of fear of detention, deportation, family separation, all of this contributes to elevated communal distrust in many ways. And I also think about the sort of economic situation, right, that I know the Economic Policy Institute just recently reported that only 16% of Latinx and 20% of African-American workers are eligible to work from home, compared to 30% of whites and 37% of Asians. And so from a socio-historical vantage point, I think communal mistrust coupled with higher rates of poverty, and all of this contributes to these high risk factors for cardiovascular and metabolic diseases, higher concentrations of African Americans, for example, working in the essential industries, in particular, Black women. All of this increases their threat of exposure, and this all results in the precarity of survival for the most vulnerable communities across the US during this pandemic.
Another common concern for rural and urban-based Latino, Black, and Indigenous peoples may be food insecurity. You know, some folks don't know what it's like to live in a food desert where fresh fruit and vegetables are unavailable, but there's a surplus of nutrient-deficient junk food. And so we may have communities who are, you know, like us, we're very fortunate to live in the city. I went to the grocery store yesterday, and of course, there were still some barren shelves, but there were options for me to buy fresh fruit and vegetables, where that's not necessarily the case when we think about really rural communities, for example, up in the Navajo Nation, where the only option may be abashas. It's unclear whether or not those healthy, nutritious options are being replenished and whether or not they're affordable at this time.
How much does access to health insurance come into play here, and what are some of the factors that have led to those inequities?
For American Indian communities, there's the option to visit Indian Health Services. This is a treaty-protected and granted right. So access to health care is available if you're in an area where you are fortunate enough to have access to a vehicle to be able to access or get to those IHS facilities. Unfortunately, you know, what we're seeing with IHS is similar to what we're seeing in other hospitals, right? So there's a reduction of PPE available. And from what I understand, there may be some tests available, but at this point, it's unclear how many screening tests and access to supplies like hand sanitizer and other types of protective gear for medical workers are available.
And I would add too, you know, for most of these communities, you know, where over 30% of the working population are working in low-wage service sector industries, basic worker rights like access to paid sick leave, living wages, healthcare benefits, health insurance, right? This coupled with larger sort of community concerns, as Dr. Solyom pointed out, around food security and access to quality health services, this really makes for a sort of combined set of heightened problems and heightened issues for, you know, survival for these folks.
So how do you both anticipate this playing out? I'm sure there are efforts underway to sort of spread this message to minority communities, especially when you look at rural communities that, you know, might not have the same kind of access to healthcare. But is this inevitable? Are there ways to stem the tide here to make sure that these people who are in these more vulnerable positions will have better access or can be more aware of this issue at this point?
Mm-hmm. I'm really hopeful. And particularly because I'm seeing traditional social justice and civil rights organizations really stepping up and putting out the necessary information and creating avenues for people to share their stories and share their experiences during this pandemic in ways that put pressure on our elected officials to demand, for example, basic demographic information about the racial disparities in infection rates and in access to testing kits, et cetera. I'm hopeful when I think about social media and the ways that people are turning to social media to document their experiences living through the pandemic. I also am hopeful with respect to, and when I think about issues of gender disparity, and the ways in which the pandemic and social distancing and sort of increased stressors related to in-home isolation has really elevated the threat of domestic violence. And so domestic violence organizations and support services are really ramping up their efforts to provide more resources and more care for folks that are living through this pandemic.
One thing to consider is, as the rise of cases per population in counties such as Navajo outpaced that of the surrounding states, including what we're seeing in Seattle and parts of New York, location tracker data from cell phones in lower versus higher income areas have shown days-long gaps in terms of when people started limiting their movement. So unfortunately, we missed the ball on making sure that there was a comprehensive public health campaign to educate people in rural communities about the importance of the steps that you can take to sort of mitigate or minimize access to areas that might be infected with the virus. Mm-hmm. But moving forward, you know, there's evidence to suggest that Indigenous communities are collectively sourcing resources to support their community. For instance, there have been GoFundMe campaigns to provide food and water for elders to prevent them from having to go out to more public spaces to access what they need. There have been universities and other industries who are donating and sending up ethyl alcohol up to the nations to provide access to resources so that they could create and disseminate their own hand sanitizer. And not in Arizona, but Bay Mills Community College, which is a tribal college in Michigan, received a request from its community 2 weeks ago to make face masks for local workers. And what they did was they used 3D printing technology to produce 3,000 shields in 3 weeks. So there is some capacity in and within Indigenous communities to find ways to mobilize, to serve each other and protect each other. But one thing that could be beneficial and expanded would be public health campaigns in a variety of different languages to ensure that all residents and all citizens understand what is happening, what resources are available to them, and how to best protect themselves and their families.
Yeah. Do you think it matters that that kind of public health message, those campaigns come from people within these communities, that it doesn't just come from the top down, from people who are, you know, not familiar with the same experience that lots of these folks are living in?
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. Again, it's important for public health officials to be working in conjunction with civil rights organizations like the NAACP and others, working with local, not just sort of state social service agencies, but also more sort of grassroots social service providers. Because again, part of the challenge with providing support, particularly with respect to healthcare and health services, is that historical sort of mistrust of institutions and health systems. And so partnering with local organizations is extremely important.
Local leaders matter. So tribal leaders should be partnering with their local community health specialists to be able to prepare and adjust messaging for the different communities within those reservation communities or even externally, because those tribal public health officials will know what resources are available to the community and where the locations are for screening or for other types of services that may be needed. For example, we haven't really talked about education, but one of the things that is coming up and has arisen thanks to this COVID-19 discussion is, you know, that a lot of low-income children really rely on their schools to be able to access nutritious meals regularly. And so being able to partner not just with public health officials, but even education experts and provide resources and direction for how children may be able to access nutritious meals is really important.
All right. That is Mako Ward, Professor of African and African American Studies at ASU's School of Social Transformation, and Jessica Soliom, Assistant Research Professor at ASU's School of Social Transformation. Thank you both so much for having this discussion with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.